Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to an evening with Rabbi Joseph Polushkin presented by the Chabad at YU Student Groups. Now, I just want to observe, there seems to be a theme. Every time Chabad at YU runs a major event, we seem to have snow. And there must be some deeper metaphysical reason for why that's the case. And it would seem that one of the great teachings of the Lubavitch Rebbe was Mesiras Nefesh, giving oneself over to the cause. And if you want to accomplish anything worthwhile in life, you have to overcome challenges to accomplish it. Anything in the side of holiness, the Rebbe says, you have to work hard for. So a major round of applause to everybody who braved the snowy weather. Okay, so tonight we're going to be talking about the Lubavitch Rebbe. Why is that a relevant topic to discuss? So, until around 70 years ago, the Jewish world was spread out, but the Jewish people were more or less spread into clear areas. You had your Ashkenazi Jews, you had your Sephardi Jews, but Jews were not really spread throughout the entire world. 70 years ago, after the Holocaust, Jewish people went everywhere. And for the first time in history, it was plausible, it was conceivable, that a Jew could be totally cut off from the Jewish people. Now, in 1951, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson became the Lubavitch Rebbe. And he set forth a vision which said that no Jew will be without a community, no Jew will be unworried for, no Jew will be unaccounted for. And today, 70 years later, we see the Rebbe's vision being carried out in an unprecedented way, even 25 years after his passing. From the most powerful metropolis to the city you've never heard of, Chabad is there. From Beijing, China, the most powerful city in the Far East, all the way to Pokhara, Nepal, which you've probably never heard of, or from Austin, Texas to Lubbock, Texas. From Anchorage to Honolulu, from Berlin to England, we could probably multiply examples, but Chabad is there. And most of us have probably come into contact with Chabad Shluchim and the Shluchim who live their lives in these fascinating locations in order to help the Jews there out. But many people know about Chabad the movement, but they do not know about the man who was behind the movement. The Rebbe is, for many, a mystery, and by many, he is misunderstood. Now, Rabbi Joseph Polushkin is a man on a shlichut, a man on a mission of his own. Rabbi Polushkin was ordained right here at Yeshiva University, but his shlichut has gone in quite a fascinating direction. Rabbi Polushkin's mission in life has been unpacking the mysteries of Judaism, taking inaccessible concepts off the arcane bookshelf, and making them accessible to the widest possible audience in his prolific writings and in his speaking across America. For example, his book, Jewish Literacy, is the most widely selling book on Judaism in the United States. And it has exposed countless Jews and non-Jews to the truths of Judaism, transcending sectarian lines. Now, in 2014, in keeping with his shlichut of demystifying the mysterious, Rabbi Polushkin set out to make the Lubavitch Rebbe understood. And with HarperCollins, he published Rebbe, the Life of Menachem and the Schneerson, which discusses how the Rebbe took Chabad, which was a war-torn, Holocaust-torn movement, and turned it into the force it is today. And tonight we have the privilege of hearing from the man himself, the man who has demystified the Rebbe just a little bit, and that demystified Judaism. Ladies and gentlemen, Rabbi Joseph Polushkin.
It means a lot for me to be speaking here at YU. I spent 6 years at YU, and they were six of the most wonderful years of my life, and I'm very happy to be here, and I'm very grateful to all of you for coming. This is a fairly nasty day in terms of weather, and thank you for coming. What set me out really to write about the Rebbe was an interesting experience I had had. I'm very friendly with a man named Zalman Shmatkin. Do any of you know Zalman? He's the head of Chabad.org. And Zalman asked me every year around the time of the Rebbe's yard site to write an appreciation. And he said, and don't publish it in an Orthodox paper. Publish it ideally either in a non-Jewish paper or in a certainly not a traditional religious journal. And in setting down my thoughts, and I know exactly when I wrote it because it was the 12th anniversary then, what struck me was, as I was thinking about it, normally when a charismatic leader of a movement dies, the movement at best will stay basically where it was, and very commonly it'll start really to decline in size. 12 years after the Rebbe's death, the number of shluchim had already doubled, and it was on a path and kept on increasing. And it made me realize that we're dealing with the rarest type of leader, a leader whose vision grows after the leader's death. And you have that in history, and not only in terms of religious Jewish life, you have it in secular Jewish life. That was the story of Herzl. But Herzl died as a very young man. He was only 44, and Zionism was still a small movement. So I'm realizing, what is it when you deal, and what are the secrets? So what I was most interested in writing really was the story of the Rebbe's leadership and his lessons of leadership, because that's really what we need to learn from. You know, it's amazing. Erich Yaffe was the head of the Union of Reform Judaism 10 years after the Rebbe's death, said, it is hard for me to say this, but I have to say it. We need to learn from Chabad. So what is it that we do need to learn from the Rebbe, and what are the power of those lessons? When Menachem Mendel Schneerson takes over leadership of Chabad in 1951, it's a relatively small movement, centered, of course, in Crown Heights in Brooklyn, and outposts elsewhere. But even then, the Rebbe had a vision that he wanted to find every Jew in the world. I don't know if any other movements in Jewish life had ever had that vision, to really go out to try and find every single person every Jew that they really could find. I don't think it was coincidental that this was only 6 years after the end of the Holocaust. As Jonathan Sacks later on put it, if the Nazis hunted down every Jew in hate, the Rebbe wanted to find every Jew in love. And I'll give you one example of it. I mean, by now the story of Chabad has become quite widely known. There are Chabad outposts in all 50 states. If you know the answer, don't give it. But if you don't know, who wants to guess? Take a guess what the 50th state, the last state to have a Chabad was. Just call out something.
Montana.
No, Montana had it earlier. I spoke to Rabbi Brook in Montana, whose mission it is to get every Jewish household in Montana to put up a mezuzah. And when I spoke to him, he had just come from a city in Montana that sounds like a shtetl. He had just come from putting up mezuzahs in Whitefish, Montana. Okay, anybody else want to guess? North Dakota, you're close, but not right. Oh, and you guessed it? You didn't know that? It is South Dakota. Okay. I feel like a comedian where somebody called out the punchline. But, you know, somebody recently, I was doing this exercise, and they guessed Hawaii. And I said, let me ask you a question. If you were a Chabad shliach, and they gave you a list of 50 states, do you really think Hawaii would be your last choice? But the truth of the matter is, I'm very pleased with the fact, when I was working on the book for several years, my research assistant was a young man named Mendel Alperovitch, and Mendel then became the shliach to South Dakota. And I went to visit him there and spoke to a group about the size of this group in South Dakota, in Twin Falls, South Dakota, which is no small feat. All of a sudden, Chabad shows up in unexpected places. My friend Dennis Prager was at the Chabad in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, with 17 other Jews on a Shabbat. Who knows every year, where is the largest Seder in the world held? In Kathmandu, which generally gets about 1,100 to 1,200 people. Most of them are young Israelis who've gotten out of the army and who go trekking around the world. So outposts were opened up. So right away we know we're dealing with a different sort of leader. Nor was the Rebbe's approach only limited to Jews. I'll give you an interesting story. In 1968, Shirley Chisholm becomes the first black woman ever elected to Congress. She represents the area in Brooklyn, Bedford-Stuyvesant, which adjoins Crown Heights, and she also represented part of Crown Heights. 1968 was only 4 years after the passage of the landmark 1964 Civil Rights Bill, and Congress was largely dominated in terms of political patronage by Southern Democrats, many of whom in those days were unabashed racists. They were not happy to see this black woman elected to Congress, and so they decide they put her on the Agriculture Committee. She was from Bedford-Stuyvesant. One New York newspaper headlined the appointment, "A Tree Grows in Brooklyn." You know, obviously, she was very, very unhappy because she said she wanted to go to Congress, she wanted to do stuff in education and labor, and they wanted to make her very peripheral. She was public about her unhappiness, and she gets a call from Rabbi Chodakov. Rabbi Chodakov was the Rebbe's closest aide for many decades, and she said, you know, the Rebbe would like to see you. The Rebbe was actually a constituent because he lived in the area that she represented. She well knew who the Rebbe was because for decades, all political figures used to come to the Rebbe. He would give them a blessing. Obviously, he was not going to give a partisan endorsement, but he was friendly to everyone. So she comes, and he says to her, "I understand you're unhappy about your appointment." And she says, "I'm insulted. I want to come to Congress. I want to do work to really help my people." And the Rebbe said to her, "You know, God has given you a very unusual opportunity. I want to give you his words. What a blessing God has given you. This country has so much surplus food, and there are so many hungry people, and you can use this gift that God's given you to feed hungry people. You have to find a creative way to do it." Her first day in Congress, she meets a new senator from Kansas, Bob Dole. Dole had been a congressman, and obviously Dole was very concerned about the farmers in Kansas who had a surplus food, couldn't sell it, they were losing a lot, and she and Dole start to work together. This is, by the way, an interesting thing. There was actually a time when Republicans and Democrats could work together, and they work together and greatly expand food stamps. Then she goes on to do Women, Infant, and Children, which provides food for mothers, poor mothers. And the whole story of Chisholm's meeting with the Rebbe was not known until 15 years later, when she was retiring from Congress. And at a breakfast that was given for her, she told the whole story of how she had gone and met with the Rebbe and what he had said to her. And at the end of her speech, this is how she concluded it. "A rabbi who is an optimist taught me that what you think is a challenge is a gift from God." And then she added, "If poor babies have milk and poor children have food, it's because this rabbi in Crown Heights had vision." So right away we understand we're dealing with a figure who moved in large terms, who thought in ways that Jewish leadership often couldn't think. And he saw it. And it was a message that had a very big impact all over. What were some of the things that were distinctive to how the Rebbe thought? Obviously, they all emanated out of traditional Jewish categories, but he saw things with a broader sort of vision. For example, the notion that every act counts. I was born in 1948, and so I was 14 when John Glenn circled the moon and the space age begins. And John Kennedy, who was president at the time, said, he predicted that by the end of the 60s, the United States would place a man on the moon. And he then quoted, in trying to reflect the significance of what Glenn had just done, he quoted the Chinese proverb, "A journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step." The Rebbe understood that, and he knew that any mitzvah could be the instrument by which you could bring somebody back to a life of real Jewish commitment. And that's what I always assumed, that it was sort of in line with that Chinese proverb. But the more I studied the Rebbe, the more I came to understand, it went a little deeper than that. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. The implication of the proverb, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step, is that every step matters because it's part of that 1,000-mile journey. The Rebbe's insight was, every step matters in and of itself. Every mitzvah counts in and of itself, even if it doesn't lead to another mitzvah. Ideally, obviously, one hopes it will, but even if it doesn't. And I'll tell you why, because I found out something that I haven't really been aware of. Obviously, Chabad became very known for the campaigns, the mitzvah campaigns. And there were 10 of them, and one of the most famous ones was the Tefillin campaign. I often explain to audiences, this is a rather more knowledgeable audience, but often when I'm explaining it to less knowledgeable audience, I'll say, Tefillin are phylacteries. Now you know what Tefillin are. Obviously, the only thing you know is that if somebody uses the word phylacteries, they don't put them on. Nobody ever said, I put on phylacteries this morning. But anyway, the Rebbe starts the Tefillin campaign. And suddenly, men are being stopped in the street in New York, and they're asked, are you Jewish? And if the person says yes, did you put on tefillin? And if the person says no, they offer them the opportunity. Not surprisingly, and by the way, the question was then asked of women too, are you Jewish? And if they answered yes, they were asked about Shabbat candles, and then they were offered Shabbat candles. Not surprisingly, when the tefillin campaign starts, a lot of more secular sorts of Jews are uncomfortable with it. First of all, Jews in general are not comfortable with people stopping them and asking them, are you Jewish? Jews have nervous associations with anything like that. And then there are a lot of Jews who are uncomfortable seeing Jewish men in the streets. They would you go into a truck, but, you know, putting on tefillin. But what is less well known is that in some Orthodox, some of the more right-wing Orthodox circles, this campaign was ridiculed. They thought it made no sense. You're going to take somebody who's a non-observant Jew, you're going to put tefillin on him, and then he'll take off the tefillin, he'll say a shema, say something, he'll take off the tefillin, and then he'll go into a coffee shop and have ham and eggs. Is there any value to that? And the Rebbe said there is value to that. First of all, you don't know where it could possibly lead. But again, even independent of where it could possibly lead, this person has now put on tefillin. This now is not a head that never had tefillin on it. This is not an arm that never had tefillin on it. This was, today, a more common way of thinking. But in those days, it was not a common way of thinking. You know, it's like a cliche. When you come across cliches in books, you know, why is a writer writing like that? But we forget that the cliche, when it was first introduced, was actually a fresh expression. And it only then became overused. So when the Rebbe first did it, this was a fresh way of viewing it. Every act like that counts on its own. On January 1st, 2000, beginning of the millennium, the New York Times publishes a special edition. There are three front pages. One front page is the front page for January 1st, 2000. They then publish the front page January 1st for 1900. You know, I mean, obviously the intention is for people to read it and see how different the world has become. And then in an act of conjecture, they also publish the front page for January 1st, 2100. And it's actually quite unsettling. There are articles, should robots be allowed to vote in elections? You know, a whole bunch of things that can make people quite uncomfortable. And then in the middle of the page, there's a little notice. Jewish women and girls, candle lighting tonight is at 5:18. How many of you remember when the New York Times used to have those classified ads? Probably not too many. But there was a period of time, and then it became, I think, too expensive, when a Jewish family in Australia, every Friday, it would be a little classified ad on the front page of the New York Times saying what time candle lighting was. What had happened on that day, I go to a shul, Ramat Orah, a small modern Orthodox shul on 110th Street, and one of my friends who sits next to me, Ari Goldman, he was the only New York Times reporter ever hired with the proviso that he didn't have to work on Shabbat or holidays. And he told me the story of it. The Times had hired, you know, had special editors working on the feature, and there was a guy, Ari thought he was an Irish Catholic, who was editing January 1st, 2100, you know, because obviously it required a lot of creative work. And the guy saw that January 1st, 2100 was actually a Friday. And it was during the period when the Times was running those ads. So somebody called up Chabad and said, what time is candle lighting going to be on January 1st, 2100? And I presume they answered, if the Mashiach has not already taken us all, no. But no, they answered, because they knew the time. And so they gave him the time. That ad explains a lot. Obviously, this really happened. I'm not making this story up. It really did happen. But it also, aside from being a little humorous and heartwarming, it also explains something else about Chabad. Chabad is the only major movement in Jewish life that draws the majority of its financial support from people who are not as observant as the movement would be. In other words, you can assume if you look at the list of major donors to Hebrew Union College, the Reform Rabbinical Seminary, I'm assuming the overwhelming majority of their supporters are in one way or another affiliated with a Reform congregation. The same goes for JTS, and the same goes in the Orthodox world, for YU and other places. You assume that most of the support, the large majority of the support, comes from people within the movement. This is not the case with Chabad. And I'll tell you one of the reasons I think that's the case. There are many Jews with warm Jewish hearts who really want to see the Jewish people survive, but who are not necessarily that confident that their great-grandsons and great-granddaughters are going to be Jewish. I mean, talking certainly outside of the Orthodox world, we know that that's the case. But they are confident that there will be Chabadniks on January 1st, 2100, going around trying to make sure that people are lighting Shabbat candles. So this is part of what emanated. So what are some of the ideas that I think were distinctive to the Rebbe? So if I say one of them, a tremendous Avas Yisrael, a tremendous love of Jews, so you'll say, well, what's so distinctive about that? First of all, we all know V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha is not only a central, is not only a command in the Torah, it's a central command. You know, Hillel viewed it as being the essence, and Akiva explicitly viewed it as being the essence. V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha zeh klal gadol b'Torah, love your neighbor as yourself, this is a, or the major principle of the Torah. But despite the fact that that emphasis existed in Jewish life, we also know it wasn't necessarily obeyed. You know, in one of the most famous passages in the Talmud attributes the destruction of the Bayit Sheni of the Second Temple to Sinat Chinam, the exact opposite of love your neighbor as yourself, to causeless hatred within the Jewish world. And it really had a poisonous effect. I'll give you an example drawn from the medieval period. One of the great tragedies in medieval Jewish life in 1240 is the burning of the Talmud in France. Now, obviously, any time the Talmud is burned, God forbid, would be a terrible tragedy. But what made it so much more particularly tragic in the 1200s? Because every one of the Talmuds that was burned, and it was like, they think like it had been like 2,400 volumes or more, every one of them had been handwritten. There was no printing press in those days. You couldn't then just reprint it. Every one had been written by hand. You can imagine how much effort. How did it come about? Why did the church at that time order the burning of the Talmud? The Catholic Church had established the Dominican Order in France in 1232 with the obligation to root out heresy in the church. They weren't concerned at first with Jews. What happened was three rabbis came to the Dominicans and told them that there was a heretical writer among the Jews whose writings they should also burn. And they did. The writer was Moshe, was Maimonides. And one of the three rabbis, when the Talmud was burned, was so overcome with remorse by what his act had helped bring about that he actually devoted the rest of his life to repenting for it. He wrote a classic work of Jewish Musar called Shaarei Tshuva, The Gates of Repentance, Yonah Gerundi. But it was all occasioned by that incident, what had happened. So there was an awareness of what hatred can cause within the Jewish community. And we know it. I mean, look, even we know in the history of Chassidut, in the early years, the Vilna Gaon, to say the least, was not a fan of Chassidut, but the vehemence was very, very strong. He said, if it was within my power to do to the Chassidim what Eliyahu HaNavi did to the priests of Baal, I would. So again, when anger gets set off, you really do need Ahavat Chinam. You really do need the opposite of it, because you need a very powerful force to overcome it, because it has been so destructive in Jewish life. So when the young rabbi Lau, who later on becomes one of Israel's eminent chief rabbis, meets the Rebbe. And the Rebbe is a young Musmach, a young recently ordained rabbi. And he asked him, what sort of work are you doing? He said, I'm involved in Kiruv Rechokim. I'm involved in bringing near those who are far away. Obviously a euphemistic term for making non-observant Jews more observant. The Rebbe answers him in a surprising way. He says, how do we know who's Karov? How do we know who's Rachok? They're all Karov. They're all near in God's eyes. In other words, the Rebbe did not want people who were teaching religion to teach it out of the standpoint of feeling superior to everybody else, because that creates a distance. You know, it's like when people speak of, oh, he's a Baal Tshuva. And who's not a Baal Tshuva? I mean, if you're not a Baal Tshuva, what are you doing in Shul on Yom Kippur? You know, it's not like people who are not Baal Tshuva are perfect tzaddikim. We all have areas where we need to be. But when you think in those terms, it automatically establishes a category, and that's what the Rebbe didn't want to see happen. When I was working on the book, one of the people I interviewed, George Rohr, George and his late father Samuel, I'm sure, are among the great philanthropists who supported Chabad. And George, in addition, you know, very often people who are philanthropists aren't necessarily that knowledgeable Jewishly. But in that case, the Rohrs really were quite learned. In fact, the Rebbe encouraged Sammy, and I interviewed Sammy shortly before he died. He encouraged Sammy to give a class in Parsha, in the Torah portion of the week. And Sammy said, I don't think I know enough. The Rebbe said, if all you know is Aleph Bet, teach Bet to those who only know Aleph. In other words, he encouraged people from very early on to see themselves not only as learners, but also as teachers. Because you know what happens also? If you're ever called upon to teach, you're going to become smarter because you're going to study more. Because you're going to want to be ready to answer questions. So it makes you go deeper when you're asked questions. George started a beginner's minyan for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur at the shul he went to, KJ, you know, the modern Orthodox shul on the upper East Side. And between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, he went and was very proud to tell the Rebbe, I want the Rebbe should know that I had 180 people with no background for Rosh Hashanah at the congregation. The Rebbe didn't seem pleased. I think George repeated it, actually. The Rebbe was quite old by then. You know, when you say something to a very old person and they don't seem to follow it, you assume that it's because they're hard of hearing. So you say it over in a loud voice. I want the Rebbe to know that I conducted a service for 180 people with no background. And the Rebbe said, what do you mean they had no background? The descendants of Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Malaya. Again, it's a whole different way of viewing people. He sees people in a different way, and it focuses on that. So what you're establishing once again, and this is going to show up again later when I speak, the Rebbe was always out there in a search for commonalities. There are people who are into conflict, and they search for what makes people different. And then there are people who like to search for what makes people more in common. And the Rebbe was always doing that. You'll find that this is one of the reasons that so many of the Chabad Shluchim are very successful in connecting to people who, when they first see the Chabad Shliach, it seems very different to them. But then we really see that what's at our essence changes things around. Look, that's what was moving to Shirley Chisholm. She didn't go into and see this man. Suddenly this man alerted her to the fact of what role she could play in helping to feed children. And so you counter people's stereotypes. One of the other features of the Rebbe, and this is a very unusual feature, I'm not saying it's unique, but it was a very unusual feature for a leader, particularly a leader of a large movement. Now, what becomes a very large movement is he always stayed focused on individuals. One of the things that people always, you know, bothers people about leaders of countries is they wonder at a certain point, do they care about individuals? And to some extent, it's hard. You know, if you're going to be a leader of a country, you're going to have to sometimes send people out on missions which will result in people's deaths. I think many of us would probably find that thought so paralyzing we wouldn't be able to do it. And yet we also understand if there was nobody who could do it, it could even be more destructive of a country. The Rebbe always stayed focused on individuals. It was an incident like that that probably was one of the factors responsible for my writing the book. My father, Shlomo Talushkin, Alav HaShalom, had been the Rebbe's accountant, even prior to the Rebbe, from the time Chabad came to the United States in 1940. So my father was the accountant for the movement, for the Friedeka Rebbe, for the 6th Rebbe, and for Menachem Mendel Schneerson, for the 7th Rebbe. In 1986, I was living in Eretz Yisrael, I was living in Israel, and I got the sort of phone call that you dread. My mother told me my dad had had a stroke, and he was in a coma, and obviously I flew home right away, and my father was in a coma for a few days, and every day I got 2 phone calls from the Rebbe's office. The Rebbe wants to know how your father is. My father then comes out of the coma, and he's somewhat diminished. I always say my father was like a person running full speed into a brick wall, because after the stroke, he could no longer really do his work anymore as an accountant. And my father used to give a weekly shiur in Talmud. He couldn't do that. But he would go in and out. But every day, I continued to get those phone calls from the Rebbe's office. And then a few days after he'd come out of the stroke, I get a phone call from Rabbi Krinsky. Yudel Krinsky was the Rebbe's very close aide. And he said, a question came up. We had a question of the Hanhola. We had a question of the leadership this morning. An accounting question came up, and the Rebbe said, ask Shlomo. So, of course, everybody said to the Rebbe, you know how sick Shlomo is. The Rebbe said, of course he knew. He said, ask, this is a question I want addressed to Shlomo. So, obviously, at that point, I took the question to my father, and my father looked at me, and he answered the question as if it was quite obvious to him. I walked out of that room, and I understood what the Rebbe had done. Here he was in Brooklyn, leading this large movement, increasingly large movement, but he was also thinking about my father, a man who suddenly was struck by a terrible illness and seemed to have lost so much, lost everything at once. And the Rebbe thought of a question that he could answer, that my father could answer. You know, it was not just that he had the good heart to think of that. He also had the seichel to think. He didn't want to ask my father a question that would, chas v'shalom, be so complicated that he would not be able to answer it. And he obviously didn't want to answer a question that would be so obvious that it would be condescending. But that was typical of what the Rebbe would do. And the ability, while so many things are going on, to be able to stay focused on a person. I think it also emanated out of another trait of the Rebbe's. I was planning to speak about it maybe a little later in the speech, but it will make sense here. People wonder, how did the Rebbe accomplish as much as he accomplished? I mean, he oversaw so many activities and was intimately involved in many. He had a concept known as Hatzlacha Bizman. Have any of you ever heard of this Chabad concept, the Rebbe's concept, Hatzlacha Bizman, success in time? The Rebbe said that he had learned that concept from his father-in-law, who had learned it from his father, the Rebbe Rashab. In 1927, before they had left Russia, Menachem Mendel was already engaged to Chaya Mushka. It was understood they were getting married. He was already sort of part of the Rebbe's family. For a variety of reasons, their marriage had to be delayed. There was tremendous poverty and there was tremendous oppression going on in the Soviet Union. And so they got married a few months later. But the 6th Rebbe was getting ready to go. They were living in St. Petersburg, and he was getting ready to go to Moscow, and they knew it was going to be a terrible trip for him in Moscow because he was being shadowed by the KGB. They were trying to find excuses to arrest him. They did eventually arrest him, and it looked like they were going to kill him, and then they were able to exert pressure, and he was released. So Menachem Mendel, I mean, I'm not speaking to him disrespectfully, I just want to identify that he was not yet Rebbe. So he goes into his father-in-law's office. His father-in-law is going to be leaving for the train station in about an hour. The whole household are nervous wrecks. And his father-in-law is sitting there doing his correspondence, acting calmly. He says, how can you be like this so calm? He said, my father, Rebbe Rashab, taught me there's a limited amount of time in a week, and there's a little amount of time of what we can do. He said, no matter how you do it, you can't expand the time in the week. You can't contract it. All that you can have, therefore, are those minutes. And therefore, what's imperative, and what I'm going to tell you now, what the Rebbe said, I try and practice it. Try and practice it if you can for 5 minutes at a time. I find it hard to do it for a lot longer, but if you can, do it for a lot longer. He said the Rebbe's attitude was, when you're working on something, don't think about anything that's happened to you in the past, and don't think about anything you have to do in the future. Think only about this particular activity. He said, because otherwise those things will intrude. I can only imagine, for many of you, as I know for many of me, my work time often gets wasted thinking about things from the past or thinking about things I have to do and not just staying focused on that one thing. And that was the Rebbe's extraordinary ability. So you meet, how many people here, well, actually this is too young a crowd, are there people here who ever met the Rebbe, like on a dollar's line? Okay. I know the experience that people describe is they felt that for those seconds they had with the Rebbe, they had his full attention. He really was focused on them. And it becomes amazing how much you can accomplish when you can, like that, be really focused on that person. So here you had someone like the Rebbe who was focusing on so many issues, but he could also focus long enough on my father to come up with a question. Shmuel Kaplan, Chabad Shliach, probably now for 40 years, in Baltimore, when he had recently he'd gotten smith, he was in a kollel, and Rabbi Chodakov, the Rebbe's aide, assigned him that there was a young woman, for some reason the Rebbe had taken great interest in her. She was really quite young. I mean, she was like a 18-year-old, in the throes of a full-fledged teenage rebellion. Very unhappy, very angry. And there was a lot of hostility. And Rabbi Chodakov told Kaplan, just be attentive to her. The Rebbe wants you to be attentive to her. And he did. And the young woman would often write letters to the Rebbe. And he said he was shocked. The Rebbe would answer always within a day. And then she wrote to the Rebbe about something that pained her. And the Rebbe wrote back, Ani magish et tzarech. The Rebbe actually was writing in the third person, Ani margish et tzara, which is a very sort of formal way, but it meant Ani margish et tzara. I feel your pain. This sentiment did not move the young woman. It actually annoyed her. She felt the Rebbe was being condescending. And she said to Kaplan, how can he say he feels my pain? He doesn't know what I'm going through. And she then wrote that back to the Rebbe. She got an answer within 2 hours. And Kaplan said, the Rebbe said, God willing, in a few years, when you'll get older and you will merit to be married and have a child, during the end of the first year or so of the child's life, it will start teething. And when the child teethes, they will also start crying. And the mother will feel that pain, and she'll cry along with the child's crying. She said, Kacha ni margish tzarech. That's why I feel. Kaplan said from that moment on, it was the first time the girl felt somebody really understood her pain. So that's why I say the first thing I wanted to focus on was that ability of the Rebbe to always stay focused on the individual. It's a remarkable ability. A second aspect of the Rebbe was, Jonathan Sacks made this point very acutely, because Sacks really considered himself, even though not a Chabadnik, obviously very aligned with Chabad, but he considered the Rebbe, he said if not for the Rebbe, he probably would not have become a rabbi. And Sacks said, a good leader creates followers. A great leader creates leaders. And he said that was the Rebbe's ability. He did not want people to just see themselves as dependent on him. People often think that the Rebbe craved followers, and I understand why they think that, because obviously the devotion of Chabadniks to the Rebbe is legendary. You know, it's very great. But that's not what the Rebbe ultimately was aiming for. And I'll give you an example. Of a rabbi who was sent out to New Haven, Yitzchak Moshe Hecht. Remember the name, because it's relevant to the story I'm going to tell. So Hecht goes out in the early 70s to New Haven, and he's having a hard time. You know, a lot of Chabadniks, like a lot of rabbis anywhere, particularly if you're a rabbi, if you're sent out to be a rabbi of a new congregation, you're sent out to open up a new territory. It's very difficult. And it's difficult, you have to get followers, You have to get supporters, getting financial support. I keep tripping over this thing. You have to get financial supporters. And so Hecht writes a letter to the Rebbe, and he says to the Rebbe, no, it's okay, you know, it's, I just figured out how, yes, I'm being clumsy, it's my fault. Okay, and he says to the Rebbe, he said, I need you to do it. I need you to do it for me. And the Rebbe writes him back, he said, apparently you don't know. I sent a man named Yitzchak Moshe Hecht to New Haven. Apparently you don't know this man. If you had come to know this man, everything would change. In other words, he sent Hecht back to himself because he said people don't realize the strength that they have within them. It came up in another case. Oh, I'm forgetting the man's name. Weinrib. Weinrib. He is the editor of the art of the Steinsaltz Talmud in English. Wait, what's his? What? Yeah, what's his first name? Yeah, Tzvi-Hirsch Weinrib. Yes, I shouldn't forget that. Tzvi-Hirsch Weinrib. You know, when I worked 5 years on the book, and I finally was like breathing a sigh of relief, I'm handing it in, and I said, people come up to me, I have a great story to tell. I said, I don't want to hear any more story. I finally closed with the book. But then I hear a story that Weinrib had said, and I called him up, and I knew this story had to go in. Tzvi-Hirsch Weinrib writes, you know, he grew up, he was a wunderkind. He was obviously very gifted Talmudist from a young age. So he's about 30 years old. He's living in Silver Springs, Maryland. He's getting a PhD in child psychology. He's working as a child psychologist at a public school, and he's also giving a shiurim a few times a week in Talmud. And he goes into what he calls an early midlife crisis. He wasn't sure where exactly he wanted to go professionally. And then he said he was having some issues, actually, also of religious faith and doubt. And a Chabad friend of his said to him, why don't you meet with the Rebbe? He wasn't sure he wanted to do that, so he calls up, though, the Rebbe's office, and he speaks to a man, he's speaking in Yiddish, and later on it became clear that it was Rabbi Chodakov. And Chodakov is sort of repeating aloud what he's saying, and then there's another man in the background who seems to be listening in. And at a certain point, the voice in the background says, who is it that you're speaking to? So he asks Weinrib, you know, who are you? And Weinrib at that point wasn't sure he wanted to come in for a meeting. And he was self-conscious, you know, that he was expressing personal issues. So he didn't want to identify himself. He just said, a Jew from Maryland. And then they continued talking, and the questions are becoming a little more probing and stuff. And then the voice from the back says, tell him to go see, there's a rabbi in Maryland named Weinrib. Tell him to go see Weinrib. So Chodakov says, did you hear what the Rebbe said? Weinrib was in shock. You know, this was before caller ID. You know, it's not like he had a way of knowing. And Weinrib, you know, couldn't believe it. He said, what did the Rebbe say? He said, you should go consult with Rabbi Weinrib in Maryland. So Weinrib says, I'm Weinrib. So now Chodakov is shocked. And he tells the Rebbe that. The Rebbe says, Azoi, if that's the case, tell him to consult with himself. And that was the heart of it. Weinrib said that answer actually had a transformative effect on his life. He said, I was one of those people who whenever I'd have a problem, I tended to always panic and start asking other people's advice. You know, I wouldn't go to myself. I would try and ask other people. He said, ever since that happened, I now, when I have a real issue, the first person I consult with is myself. He said, I'll go, I'll sit down on a comfortable chair, lean back. He said, I'll often pick up an article of something from a sicha, from a talk of the Rebbe. And he said, and then I'll just relax and think, what is it that I really want? Obviously, sometimes he still will consult with other people. But he said, it's amazing how often the answers could come from within me. This is another truth, and if you want to be a leader, can you consult with yourself? When Jonathan Sacks was only 21, he came to America, and he wanted to meet leading Jewish figures in America, and he managed to secure a meeting with the Rebbe. And the Rebbe, you know, Sacks was an impressive intellect from a young age, and he was trying to decide between going into economics or into philosophy or into law, and the Rebbe really pushed him to go into Jewish leadership work. But Sacks said, at a certain point in the conversation, he said to the Rebbe, I recently found myself in a situation. And the Rebbe said, don't use that expression. say you placed yourself in a situation. Because if you say, I found myself in a situation, then it's like you have no control over it. But if you placed yourself in a situation, guess what? You can then place yourself in another situation. In other words, he didn't want people to view their lives in a passive way. He wanted people to understand the active role that they could play. And if they could play one role, then they can play a different role. And it gives people a much greater sense of authority over their own lives, of what they could do. Another characteristic feature of the Rebbe was what I call, he had an innate sense of optimism, but he was very concerned with the optimistic usage of words. Very early on, I was speaking to a significant figure within Chabad, Simon Jacobson. And I remember I'm talking with Simon, and he told me that the Rebbe, well, you'll just see what I mean in a second. I'm just going to say a word in English, call out the word in Hebrew. You'll see, I think, a large majority of you know it. How do you say hospital in Hebrew? Yeah, Beit Cholim. The Rebbe never liked to use the word Beit Cholim. So I said, why? He said, because it's a very pessimistic word. What does it mean, the house of the sick? The Rebbe spent years writing hospitals in Israel, and he actually influenced a couple. They should change their name to Beit Refuah, House of Healing. Because he thought just telling people you're in a house of the sick, you know, has a negative impact on them. When I heard that from Simon, it reminded me of a childhood memory I had. My mother told me, my mother who was born in 1912, so she was growing up in the 20s, my mother told me that when she was growing up, there were hospitals in New York called Home for the Incurables. There were Jewish homes for the incurables. There were Catholic homes for the incurables. I mean, can you imagine going into somebody's room and saying, by the way, we're transferring you tomorrow to the home for the incurables? Now, it was horrible. I remember I was once reading a biography of Yossele Rosenblatt. Yossele Rosenblatt was like the most famous Jewish chazan in the first half of the 20th century. And Rosenblatt had obviously given a performance at the Montefiore Home for the Incurables, the president of whom was Jacob Schiff, who was sort of the very big American Jewish philanthropist at that time. And I saw the thank you letter that Schiff had written to Cantor Rosenblatt. He said, thank you for the good cheer you brought to the inmates at the Home for the Incurables. And I thought, genug, it's enough there at the Home for the Incurables, you have to refer to them as inmates, you know. So there was an insensitivity, and the Rebbe didn't want that. And this position of the Rebbe also became known in another context. There are handicapped soldiers in Israel who are known as Nechei Tzahal, which means the handicapped of Tzahal, of the Israeli army. And obviously it refers to people who suffered wounds that cannot be fully healed. And in 1976, the Israeli Defense Ministry sent a bunch of Nechei Tzahal to the United States, both to give them, you know, a pleasant experience and also to consult with doctors, and they also wanted to meet with the Rebbe. The Rebbe overwhelmingly gave his public talks in Yiddish. In later years, he sometimes spoke to Russian Jews in Russian. The Rebbe could comfortably speak in seven languages. He was a real linguist. But he very rarely gave a public oration in Hebrew, but he did. He apologized to the soldiers because he had a very thick Ashkenazic accent, which he knew to young modern Israelis was going to be a little hard to follow. But he said, I understand that in Israel they call you Nechei Tzahal, the handicapped of Tzahal. He said, but it's also known that handicapped people develop other abilities, other strengths. It's known that people who are blind often develop a more acute sense of hearing. It's not that their hearing is better than other people's. It's that they notice the implications of things that other people won't notice. If you go online tonight and Google people who paint who can't use their hands, people who paint with paintbrushes between their toes or with paintbrushes coming out of their mouths, you'll be shocked at the quality of paintings that you will see. So the Rebbe said, all of you are developing other capabilities. Why then should you only be defined by what you can't do? Why can't you be defined what makes you different, what makes you exceptional, what makes you Mitsuyanei Tzahal? The extraordinary ones of Tzahal. It reminded me when I read that of an account I had read years earlier of an American soldier who during World War II had lost his arms and was in an army rehab hospital. And the day before he was released from the rehab hospital, you know, an army officer came to speak to him and to the other people being released and experienced, you know, and expressing what they call like tough love. You know, we don't want to be unduly sentimental. He said, listen, this year you're all going to be army heroes. Next year you're going to be disabled veterans. By the third year you're going to be cripples. That's what people are going to think of you as. As opposed to the message the Rebbe sent them out into the world with, Mitsuyanei Tzahal, define yourselves by those of your strengths. How much damage is often done to children in a less extreme way when people just focus on their weaknesses and not on their strengths? And there is a tendency, unfortunately, to do that. You know, I always think, you know, when parents will come back from a parent-teacher night and they will have gotten 5 good reports and 1 not good report, and suddenly the 1 not good report, that's the most important thing. Always. We give too much credence to that. Or when they punish a kid, you know, a kid who's the only thing he's good at basketball, so then they kick him off the team because his academic performance is not good. That's a really smart technique. The person has one thing they're proud of, so take that away from them also. No, you build through by focusing on people's strengths. That's what so much of the Rebbe's message was. He didn't like to use negative words in any context. I'll give you one. I'm a writer. Obviously, what's a very important word for a writer? If you have to deliver something by a certain time, you're working on... Right. He hated that word. And think about it. It's a pretty awful word. Yeah, I'm on deadline. So you know what I started using instead? Due date. Think about the difference between deadline and due date. You know, you can do it. And he never liked to say, he wouldn't like to say something was ra. He'd say, hefech hatov. Actually, I'm going to start crying because I just happened to be watching today. My wife, Devorah, and I had years ago, we had been in Mumbai, and we were actually at the Chabad in Mumbai for a Shabbos a few months before they were murdered. I'm forgetting their names. Rivka and Gabi. Yeah, and Gabi. And the last words that anybody ever heard Gabi speak was, they reached on a phone and they just got cut off, and he said, Amatzav Loto. He said, the situation is not good. Even then he didn't say Ra. He just said Loto. And it reminded me of this aspect of the Rebbe. I was very punctilious in my book in not using anonymous material. Because you never know whether anonymous material is true or not true. It's much easier for people to exaggerate. But there was one story I heard enough different times that and it was so reflective, the way the Rebbe spoke, that I did include it, where a man came in to speak to the Rebbe, and you know, he was complaining, he was unhappy, and he was very unhappy. He had a son who had sort of left the derech, had become non-religious, and at a certain point, he sort of like hit his head, you know, hand against head, and he said, oh, you know what they say, as stressed as I'm a Yid. You know what they say, it's hard to be a Jew. So the Rebbe said to the man, he said, I'm curious, do you often use that expression? So the man said, well, it is hard to be a Jew. So the Rebbe said, well, then why are you so surprised your son doesn't want to be a Jew? Why don't you start saying, es ist gut zu sein a Yid. It's good to be a Jew. Again, the tendency to focus on the negative, he wanted to really counter it. And he had that sort of innate sense of optimism. I have no idea. What time is it? 9:30. Okay. I'm going to go on for a few more minutes, but let me go on with another thought that the Rebbe had, which I think has a lot of relevance to the contemporary situation in America. Lav dafka for Jews. The contemporary situation in America in a variety of ways. We can see that the Rebbe was careful in how he used, you know, language. He wanted to use positive things. I have a chapter on the Rebbe I call How to Disagree Without Being Disagreeable. It starts there with a letter he got from a rabbi who was angry about a position the Rebbe had taken. I think I know it was over the Mihu Yehudi issue, but I'm not, who was a Jew issue, but I'm not sure if that's what it was. I have reason to think it was. But anyway, but it was a really angry letter at the Rebbe. And the Rebbe starts out his answer by saying, first of all, there are 612 areas on which we do agree. And that's what he wanted, you know, to focus on. Obviously, he was speaking metaphorically of the Tariag Mitzvot. But the point he wanted to make was, there's so often a tendency when people disagree with somebody on one issue that that comes to dominate over other issues. Think of the vituperativeness that goes on in political life and in religious life. What can happen? Where people lose a sense of the essential commonality. The Rebbe wanted to focus on commonalities. Every 4 years during American presidential elections, I like to ask audiences, can you think of a single reason, one reason, somebody is voting for the candidate whom you oppose that doesn't reflect badly either on the person's intelligence or the person's goodness? And I rarely find liberals who can do so, and I rarely find conservatives who can do so. Obviously, if you end up not thinking there's a single reason, if you can't find any partial truth in the position of the other person, you're going to end up thinking that the people on the other side are either stupid or bad. And if you know that they're not stupid, you're going to end up probably demonizing them. You know, and so the Rebbe wanted to hold that back because it has a terrible impact on how we view people, how you can love people with whom you can have disagreements. And this becomes a very characteristic feature and stress, and it's basic to the Chabad Shluchim. You see them, you know, all over the country. You can't politicize every matter. I have a dream that I've been trying for years. I don't know if it'll ever happen. I want to establish a national Speak No Evil Day in the United States. For one day, you can't say anything critical about or to anyone. And I was actually able in 1996 to get two senators to sponsor it. Joe Lieberman, not surprisingly, was the Democrat, and his friend Connie Mack, who's a Republican, they sponsored it. Never got enough support, so I still have it out there. I still hope some organization's gonna take it over. And it was very nice. I spoke a couple of weeks ago in Denver, where a rabbi in Denver has started a clean speech campaign to get for a month everybody to work on their speech. And he got all the organizations, an Orthodox guy, but he got across the board all the Jewish organizations to help sponsor it. And his goal is obviously to influence the non-Jewish world as well. I would love this to be a Jewish contribution to America because it's a religious idea, but it's not denominational. It's not ritual. The whole notion of Lashon Hara, because what's startling to people is you ask most people who've heard the term Lashon Hara, they assume they'll say it's gossip. They'll say, is it true? Is it not true? And what they don't realize is Lashon Hara, by definition, is true. But the fact that it's true doesn't mean that it's anybody else's business. How many of you here can think of at least one incident in your life that you do not want anybody else here to know about? What am I, in a room of total tzaddikim? Okay, you know, of course, you know, and we would regard, because it would be embarrassing, and we would regard anybody who would spread it as an enemy. Even if they said, well, it's true, isn't it? Yeah, the fact that it's true. Because we know that by definition, it's a slightly tantalizing truth that will then become people's primary association with us. And so therefore, that sort of rectitude, Rabbi Michal Seligson, who wrote probably the fattest book I own, it's like a 6-pound index to the Rebbe's, all the Rebbe's sichas. He said he could not remember an instance in which the Rebbe attacked someone by name. He said, the Rebbe would say, I speak about shitot. I speak about approaches. I don't speak about people. And it's remarkable. Why does that matter? I'll tell you why it matters. The Rebbe, for example, one of the Rebbe's positions, and it was a position I didn't agree with, and Chabad knew, they were cooperating with me in writing the book, was he was opposed to demonstrations on behalf of Soviet Jewry. He thought that it was going to end up being bad for Russian Jews. And I, as a young person, have been very involved in the student struggle for Soviet Jewry. In any case, so the Rebbe on one occasion really attacked a demonstration that was going to happen. And it's somebody who could have called it the demonstration, and the Rebbe was critical that the person didn't. And in Chabad, I asked, who is he talking about? And they said, we don't know. But in the course of my research, I was able to conclude who it was that he was speaking about. Somebody who worked in the Israeli consulate. In any case, I also know from another incident that 6 months after that attack on that person's position, he enlisted that person's support on another cause on which they could agree. Who knows how many things, good things could have happened in Israel? How many good things could happen in America if people hadn't alienated people by attacking them and not just their position? You can attack someone's position without making it seem like the other person's a terrible person. But it's very hard to work with somebody who you think has attacked your integrity. And that was part of the gift, such a gift that the Rebbe was offering. Okay, I'll just conclude with one last thought. I'm going to start a sentence in English, fill in the last word. Usually it's an expression we heard from our parents when we were kids. Anything worth doing is worth doing well. The Rebbe's approach was anything worth doing is worth doing now. And Shapsi Katz was a rabbi in Pretoria, South Africa. Pretoria is outside of Johannesburg. It's the capital of South Africa. And he was, in the late 70s, he was a rav. He was a rabbi to a small Jewish community. But more significantly, when he came to meet with the Rebbe, and what the Rebbe was most interested in was he was in charge, he was the head chaplain for Jews in prison in South Africa. And in the late 70s, many of the Jews who were in prison were, you were not surprised to learn, were political prisoners because of the campaign against apartheid. So the Rebbe asked Rabbi Katz, he said, you know, he's describing the condition of Jews in South African prisons, and as you can imagine, it's terrible to be in a prison anywhere in the world, and South Africa was worse, you know, than many other places. And the Rebbe said, what holidays, because he had, when you were a prisoner, you had forced labor. He said, what holidays does the government recognize? And he said, it recognizes Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Pesach. The Rebbe said, does it allow Jews to light candles on Hanukkah? And he said, no. So the Rebbe said to him, do you know how important a candle is to somebody in prison? Do you know how important it is, the light of a candle in the darkness of a prison? And he spoke so movingly of it to Rabbi Katz, that Katz said to the Rebbe, next year I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure Jews are allowed to light Hanukkah candles. But so the Rebbe says to Katz, but what about this year? And it was the day before Hanukkah. So he said, what can I do? I'm here in Brooklyn. The Rebbe said, do you know the phone number of the chief chaplain in South Africa? And Katz acknowledged that he did. And then the Rebbe said to him something that would make all of us exceedingly uncomfortable. He said, I want you to call him right now. It was the middle of the night. And Katz said to the Rebbe, it's the middle of the night. And the Rebbe said, even better. He'll realize it must be something very important. So Katz, you know, it was very hard to, no matter what you felt like doing, it was very hard to disobey the Rebbe if he says to you directly. So he ends up calling this General Sefton, the guy's name was, I remember from the research. And he reaches him in the middle of the night. And he gets an agreement. He said, tomorrow morning I'm sending out a telex to all the prisons in South Africa. You know, he said to Sefton when he reached him, why are you calling me in the middle of the night? He said, I'm sitting here with one of the great Jewish rabbis, one of the greatest Jewish rabbis in the world. And he said how important it is for prisoners to be able to have the light, you know, of a candle and how much it'll give them a sense of hope. And he really did it. And he came back and reported it to the Rebbe. And when he went back to South Africa, the Rebbe gave him two books about Chabad to give to Sefton and to Sefton's wife. And the widow, by the time I was writing the book, Shapsi Katz was dead. But the widow related that he came back, he called up Sefton, and he said in 20 minutes Sefton was at his house to get the books. He said, if there's a rabbi in Brooklyn who's worrying in the middle of the night about prisoners here, I want to know more about that man. So the power of these things, look at the areas that we looked at. You know, the fact that he focused love, that he always stayed focused on the individual, that his love was non-judgmental, what he said to Rabbi Lau, Kiruv Rechokim, he said, how do we know who's Karov, how do we know who's Rachok? His concerns, you know, with leadership, that great line that he said to Jonathan Sachs, don't say you found yourself in a situation, say you placed yourself in a situation. The concept of Hatzlacha Bizman, of striving, and this is a hard one, striving, when you're working on something, to only think about what you're working on and push off thoughts about the future and put off thoughts about the past. The focusing on positive language, you know, not Nechei Tzahal, but Mitzuyanei Tzahal, the exceptional ones of Tzahal. Not to speak about deadlines. Anything worth doing now. These are all ideas of the Rebbe that all of us can incorporate into our lives. These are ideas I want to adapt it also in a way to make it as accessible to non-Jews as well as Jews, because these are ideas that are all have transferable abilities, and they're really, I think, at the root of the leadership and why Chabad has been able to appeal to so many people of such different backgrounds and different means, because they are all addressed. They address the most basic needs that one could imagine. Okay, I'll tell you one last story. Abraham, well, the last thing I said was the last point. I didn't say the last story. Then I have a joke. No, I'm actually then finished. Avraham Berkowitz was a Chabad shliach now. But Avraham, when he was not yet married, so shluchim were all married. He, you know, was not yet even a musmach. He wasn't yet ordained. He, for 3 years, he and a friend, every summer would go to Alaska. There's been a Chabad in Alaska since the 70s, Rabbi Yosef Greenberg. But they would go to Alaska, and their shlichus, they were trying to reach Jews in the outlying communities of Alaska. So you can imagine, we're talking about very tiny Jewish communities. And Chabadniks are not known for being shy, so they managed to befriend a pilot in the Alaskan Airlines, who I think was an Israeli. And whenever he had some extra seats, he would tell them, and he would be going to outlying communities, and he'd say, look, you have to leave when I leave, and you have to, you know, go back when I go back, but otherwise you can have a few hours. So they come to northwest Yupik territory, to a city there, a city, by the way, actually, which obviously it's called Bethel, but obviously it's a biblical name. It's obviously Bethel. And they get off there, and they find... So they're in the middle of an Alaskan city that's made up of Native Americans. Obviously, when we say Native Americans in the continental U.S., we're referring to what we think of as Indians, but there is what we used to call Eskimos, Inuits. So they find the mayor of the town, and they tell him, are there any Jews here? He said, I don't know of any. But I'd like you to go to the public school, because the children here... The mayor knew enough to understand these were Jews, these were religious Jews. The children here will never meet rabbis. You probably assume they were rabbis. And it would be good for them to meet you. So they go to the public school, and they talk to the kids there. And the kids show off. They do an Inuit dance for them. They do a Hasidic dance for the kids. And then they're about to leave. And as Avraham told me, he said, but I'm on a shlichus from the Rebbe. I have to ask. So I asked the children, have any of you ever met a Jew? And a girl of Inuit appearance says, I know a Jew. He said, who? She said, my mother. Her mother was standing there. Her mother was a teacher at the school. Her mother, and so after the session ends, he goes over to the girl with the mother. And the mother had came from the continental U.S., had gone hiking in Alaska, was a bit of a nature freak, had fallen in love with a man there. And she was not... She was obviously not an involved Jew, but she was not negative. You know, she didn't have a dislike of it. In fact, she said to Berkowitz, she said, you're probably the only rabbi my daughter's ever going to meet in her life. Tell her something about her Jewishness that she could cherish. So he knew he had this one opportunity to reach the girl. So he said to the girl, he started to tell her a little about Shabbat. Every week for 25 hours, the Jews refrain from technology and other things. But then he says, and how does the Sabbath inaugurated each week? By women lighting candles. He said, and they light candles where the sun first goes down. Where is that? The girl's mother, I think, taught geography in the school. So the girl said, probably New Zealand or Australia. And he said, yes. So Jewish women are lighting candles there. And then it moves across. And then it moves across Asia. And it moves across Europe, and then it comes to New York, and then women are lighting candles in Chicago, and then in Seattle, and then in Anchorage. And she said, and yet there's still one place where candles have not yet been lit, here in the northwest Yupik territory, and the whole Jewish world is waiting for you to light candles. Thank you. Okay, if anybody has any comments or questions, I'd be open. Oh, yes, sir. Did the Rebbe ever acknowledge that he was wrong? He did not, I believe. Somebody wrote me and claimed that the Rebbe, that there was a letter. I said, if I could see that letter, I said, that would be a very valuable letter. That the Rebbe, because one of the people with whom we disagreed with on that issue was Elie Wiesel. And Elie Wiesel was a boundless admirer of the Rebbe. And Wiesel said that when he got married, the largest bouquet of flowers he got was from the Rebbe. And he would write to the Rebbe with his questions, his arguments against God, and the Rebbe would answer him, and then the Rebbe said, but what has that to do with the fact, why are you not getting married? You know, because Wiesel got married at a later age. So somebody claimed they saw that there was a letter that the Rebbe said to Wiesel that he thinks he might have erred in that. And I don't believe it. I don't think the Rebbe did. I think that it was actually good that there were, believe me, there were no shortage of people in Chabad, like Avram Shem Tov, who kept trying to convince me why I was wrong on this issue. I think it was good that there were Jews actually on both sides of the issue. I think there were things that could be achieved. You know, it's like the good cop, bad cop thing that they have. I think it was a passionate issue of my life. But I think it worked, that there were things that could be done by people on both sides of the issue. I'm happy most Jews did take the position of it, but what the Rebbe was able to do with Chabad, I'll tell you who told me the story. I think it was Yaakov Herzog. Yaakov was the son of Rabbi Herzog, who worked, I think, in Golda Meir's office, and I think he said he once got a briefing from a State Department official that he said, the Soviets have managed to infiltrate every potential protest movement in the Soviet Union, he told them, except for some little Jewish religious movement with its headquarters in Crown Heights. They've never been able to penetrate them. And the level, my father, Alav HaShalom, you know, who was the accountant, so my father worked out literally, he was there once a week. He had a desk right outside, a few other desks right outside the Rebbe's office. My father said people would sometimes show up from the Soviet Union who had just gotten out, who were Talmidei Chachamim. I mean, it's beyond belief. How did they have that learning? So Chabad was able to maintain this network of underground schools. So it was doing some remarkable things, even though on this issue, you know, I disagreed. But it really only came to fruition in the aftermath of the Six-Day War, when the Soviet Jews themselves were so influenced. And there, the Rebbe was open to things. Like, for example, when the Rebbe heard that the novel Exodus, I don't even know how well known it is anymore. How many people here ever read the novel Exodus? Okay. Anybody who's my age read that, read the novel Exodus. You know, it's as far removed from the sort of reading that you could imagine the Rebbe would want. It was a secular, in the context of a secular, so a lot of it is a love story. It tells the story of the creation of Israel, but from a very secular perspective. But when the Rebbe heard the power that this book had on many people, I have a friend who's now a conservative rabbi in Palm Beach. He told me he read that book. He was given that book. It was illegal to own the book in the Soviet Union. He was given the book. He had one day to read it. And he was like the 400th person or someone who had read it. He said he read the book and he decided to make Aliyah and live Russia because of it. And the Rebbe said that book should also be smuggled in. The Rebbe was much broader than people realized. And he knew that things that worked for some people wouldn't work for others. So, but I do know that the Rebbe, because the first book I ever wrote was a book I wrote with my friend Dennis Prager when we were in our 20s. It was then called Eight Questions People Ask About Judaism. A few years later, it's just by the way, I'm just telling you this, it just shows an interesting issue. So in 1981, we were given the opportunity we had self-published the book, and then Simon & Schuster bought it, and they wanted us to re-edit it because, you know, we were a little older, and add on another question. They wanted us to get old readers to buy the new book. So he added a ninth question. You know what the ninth question was in 1981? Is there a difference between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism? So it just shows how long that issue's been. But I had written it in the mid-70s, and my father, you know, of course, was very proud, and, you know, gave it to the Rebbe. I don't know how the Rebbe managed to read what he read. I do believe he had some superhuman abilities, because it's not... But he came back to my father. He really wanted that chapter eliminated, arguing for big protests for Soviet Jews, because he thought it was going to have a negative effect. But I never got the definitive answer that I wanted. And when that somebody said they saw that letter, I said, I'd give a lot to see that letter, but I don't think it's going to appear. Yes, sir. Yeah, you. Right. It's not my understanding. The Rebbe said the issue for him was not visiting Eretz Yisrael, it was leaving Eretz Yisrael. He had a position that once you visited Israel... For other people, he had the position that if you visited Israel for more than 30 days, you were forbidden to leave. Rabbi Krinsky told me there was a terrible episode in 19... This is good. People are asking me questions I don't normally get asked, so make sure that things don't just lose my, you know... When you get older, your memory starts not working quite as well. So it's reminding me of things. So in 56, there had been a terrible incident in Israel where Arab terrorists... Remember, in October of 56, Israel started the Sinai War. So because it was in response to Arab terrorism, and Kfar Chabad was attacked, and like five people were murdered, and it was terrible. And Rabbi Krinsky was one of a group of 10 young Chabadniks who was sent by the Rebbe to sort of nechama as a consolation. And I remember Krinsky told me, the Rebbe said, you cannot stay for more than 30 days without leaving Israel. I was present at a yechidus that my grandfather had with the Rebbe, and they actually got into a halachic argument on this, because my grandfather was then in his late 80s, was going to Israel, and was planning to stay for 7 weeks. And I think the Rebbe wanted to go to a lot in the middle of the, you know, outside of the biblical borders. So I think that was the issue. Now, but I'll tell you an interesting thing. I love stories where two people, like, have an argument, and each of them comes out looking good, and it really happens. I have a great story in the book of Ariel Sharon and the Rebbe. Ariel Sharon comes to the Rebbe, I think it was after the 73 war, and he says to the Rebbe, look at all the influence you have. Look at the power you have. Could you imagine what would happen if you made Aliyah? And how many thousands of Hasidim would follow? He says, you know what the motto is of the Israeli army? Acharai, follow me. The officers say Acharai. And, you know, and that was a really powerful challenge to the Rebbe. And the Rebbe answered, he says, Acharai is one model of leadership. Another model of leadership is the captain on a ship. And the captain on the ship is the last one who leaves. And he felt that he didn't want Chabadniks to ever desert a community. Look, having said that, do I wish the Rebbe had visited Israel? Yes. But he really... Now, it's true, by the way. Think about it. His father-in-law visited Israel. His father-in-law visited Israel in 1929. His father-in-law actually was in Hebron less than 2 weeks before the terrible massacre of Hebron. But I think the Rebbe actually had his halachic position that he didn't think if he visited, he could leave.
Even if it was less than
3 days? Apparently for himself. You know, like there are people who issue halachic rulings, but then take a more machmir, you know, more... That's as far as I could say it. Because, look, there were two... You know, there was another person who only visited Israel once and never went back, which was Rav Soloveitchik. The Rav went to Israel in 33, and for a variety of reasons. He didn't have such a pleasant experience there. So, because he was supposed to become the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, and listen, anyone who gets involved in political things in Israel, it's not always the easiest thing. But anyway, that's as far as I can ascertain. No, maybe I'll take one more because I'm losing my voice. Is it your hand? Yes.
Did Rebbe ever talk about or write about the children?
Right. Did the Rebbe ever write about the pain of not having children? No, he really didn't. And virtually no one would ever have the chutzpah, you know, and I'm using the word chutzpah as you can understand. Now, there was one very major, I will not mention the man's name, there was one very, very major leading figure in Chabad who couldn't, also did not have children, and used to plead with the Rebbe and, you know, and was once seen, you know, with tears in his eyes, pleading with the Rebbe, because Chabadniks felt that the Rebbe's bracha was everything. And the Rebbe, apparently, with tears in his eyes, say, I don't have. One Chabadnik, and this was an example in the book where, for understandable reasons, I did keep this story anonymous. One Chabadnik told me that he had offered one of his children to the Rebbe. He didn't want me to record that story because that son never knew that his father had made such an offer, and he didn't want him to find out by reading my book. But he and his wife decided that they would go to the Rebbe and make such an offer. No, there was a letter when the Rebbe was really quite old already. Young kids, bar and bat mitzvah age children, who would write to get a bracha from the Rebbe. And there was a young woman, I mention her name in the book, because there's obviously nothing embarrassing about it, but she wanted to put in a bracha to the Rebbe that he and his wife should still have children. The Rebbe was then about 80. Maybe she had just been reading Breishit, you know. I don't know. But in any case, but she knew, she was obviously smart enough to realize that if she put that into the letter, they might not let the letter go through to the Rebbe. So she put it into an acrostic, this is my son Ben Sion. Hi. Yeah, right. Yes, you mirror the letters, right. So instead of Aleph, you write Taf, and, you know. And so she wrote the bracha to the Rebbe, and, you know, obviously whoever saw it probably didn't know what it was. The Rebbe wrote back to the girl in the same acrostic style, thanking her for her good wishes. But, listen, we can only... Oh, okay, I'll tell you another thing, what I realized in doing research on the book. They obviously found out quite early in the marriage. Quite early, not in a year, but within 5 years or so, that it did not look good. I don't know if in modern things it could be different, but certainly in that point. And why do I say that? Because when they published the later volumes of the Friedrich Rebbe's letters, if we see the letters written to the Rebbe in the late 20s and early 30s, from both fathers, constant brachas, you should have children, and you know all the things you'd expect. After about 5 or 6 years of marriage, we stopped seeing, because obviously they knew it was too raw pain, and they didn't. It was hard, you know. I read about it in the book, in the chapter, again, because the only things we can infer, the Rebbetzin loved children. And the Rebbe did. The Rebbe also did. He was playful with children. And she loved children. I see a letter there where, you know, one of the women, her six-year-old son had been there, you know, and the Rebbetzin then said to her, "You'll forgive me, but I couldn't restrain myself. I just was hugging him," you know. So we can only imagine the pain. And obviously they became, they saw the Shluchim as their children. They really did. And when the Rebbetzin died, you know, the Rebbe said, when he sent out the note to the Shluchim, these were their children. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, somebody asked me a happier question. Yeah, right. I want to end on some other note. Let me think of something funnier or happier. I don't have too many funny stories. So the Rebbe had a sense of humor. Okay, yes. Do I ever visit the OL? What do I feel? I feel, well, my son does, well, he visited the OL. My son, Ben Sion, we got a call after Ben Sion was born. The doctor said,
It's better news than worse news. He says, your son was born with 11 fingers, not 9. So, because he was born with 2 thumbs on one hand. And it turns out, do you know that in New York City there actually are doctors whose specialty is people born with an extra finger? But they don't want to take it off when the child's very young, because it can then grow back. So we waited until like a year and a half, and we went. I went with my mom. My wife was there with Ben. We went and prayed at Yoho. First of all, I have another reason to go to Yoho, because my grandfather, Lava Shalom, and my father were both buried there. So, yes, I feel that there is a connection there. Yeah. And anytime there's illness in our family, even if I don't go, I ask for prayer to be offered there. There was something about once in my life, not once, there was a woman that my wife and I were very friendly with, who was the only time I ever met somebody who I feel was a genuine psychic. Has anybody here ever met somebody who they thought had psychic abilities? Okay, well, this woman did, so I was open to it. What is a psychic ability suggest to me? If somebody is capable of knowing something that they either, without having read about it or without having heard about it from somebody, then it has to have come from some other ability. So we knew a woman who seemed to have that ability. So I was open to the belief that that could be. There were too many things that he knew that he could not have acquired through the normal, he could not have had the time to have done all that level of reading, and he had not really heard about it. And so he had abilities of a different sort. I didn't focus on that on the book, though I was open, obviously. I was open to discussing it, because I think the real greatness of the Rebbe was the traits that we could also try and emulate. Because that's, I think, ultimately what he wanted. He certainly didn't want. Okay, yes. The only story that I can think of, okay, there's a story, the Rebbe did, of course, have a relationship with Rav Soloveitchik. And, it's interesting because, here they're both known by those words, the Rebbe and the Rav. And I suspect that even in 100 years, it's going to still be used to refer to Rav Schneerson and to Rav Soloveitchik. I got to finish. You got the final question. And there was a great mutual admiration. There is no question that there was a tremendous mutual admiration between them. Okay, I'll tell you one halachic question that came up, which I could know. The rabbi who told it to me, I list his name in the book, and it was fine with him in the book. I don't know if he wants me to talk about it publicly. When I was doing the questioning, the interviews in the book, one of the positions the Rebbe had, which I don't, it sounds presumptuous for me to say, I don't agree with, but in any case, obviously that's what I'm heading. There's a halachic problem, as you know, on the issue of adoption. Because since adoptive parents are not the biological parents of the child, so there's no biological relationship, so potentially there could be a big issue when a boy turns 13 or a girl turns 12, of yichud, negiyah, things like that. And that's why the Rebbe was never particularly a big pusher of adoption. I was speaking to a very dear friend of mine, a rabbi who I know very well, who he and his wife have adopted several children, and he is a real Talmid of Rav Soloveitchik. And before they adopted their first child, he went to the Rav. And he asked the Rav his position, and the Rav said that he felt, as he understood it halachically, particularly when you have an adoption when a child is very, very young, that it establishes an existential relationship, and we are not concerned about the issues, therefore, of negiyah and yichud. So my friend said to the Rav, he said, and how do you relate to the position of the Rebbe? Because the Rebbe's position had recently been given a lot of attention, So Rav Soloveitchik said to my friend, he said, so what do you think the Rebbe does if there's a couple in his community who he thinks should adopt? So my friend said to him, what does the Rebbe do? The Rav said, he sends them to me to Paschal and Shiloh. And I would not have put that story in if I didn't have the person attesting to it. If you want to find out who it is, you got to buy the book.
Thank you very much.